This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
You are listening to The 10th Voice. You know what it means if it's the second Saturday. I'm Elizabeth Anderson, your host for the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club. And today we are talking about The Prince of Los Cocuyos by Richard Blanco, a memoir, nonfiction, for Hispanic Heritage Month, which starts in September. And the guests today, the panelists, are M.G. Salazar. Hi, M.G.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Carol Rosenfeld, in from New York City. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Glad to be here.
And we're expecting Miguel Morales. He should be here shortly. But let's begin by talking, and I said this in the promo for the show. Normally, I would ask a question like, what have you read? What genres do you enjoy? But I want to do something different because of what is going on with immigration and natural disasters, hurricanes, fire disasters, water flooding. And we have with us M.G. Salazar, a water protector. So would you tell a little bit about your background, how you decided to do that and what you've done?
Well, being a water protector sort of evolved naturally. I'm native and Latinx from New Mexico, and I saw the video back in, actually about a year ago, of what was going on in Standing Rock. And so the only time that I could get out there was in Thanksgiving time, or what we call Thanksgiving time. So I went out to Standing Rock the first time then, and went back and got there on the day of Trump's inauguration in January. So I spent a lot of time cleaning up camp and participating in direct action, and now I work a lot fundraising for various other water protectors who are still traveling and at camp and doing other direct actions, as well as I'd like to spread the word about it as much as possible as well. So,
and you've had water protectors come to Kansas City.
Absolutely. We've had a lot of water protectors come to Kansas City. We actually have a really strong Kansas City base of water protectors. And we had Lead Horse Choctaw and Nettie Cazione come over from Ithaca, New York. And Lead Horse was arrested at the Black Hoop Camp during, I believe it was March 1st, he was arrested. And he was actually released as John Doe because he refused to give them any sort of information. And they had no evidence against him, so they had to release him. So
many people in the LGBT community are aware of the pipeline because of Facebook and news, but they may not fully understand why this is a bigger issue than just that one pipeline.
Well, there's pipelines that are stretching out all over the United States. There, obviously, earthquakes have resulted from fracking. There's been hundreds of thousands of oil spills that are sometimes so small that they go unreported, but the damage that's done to the ecological environment around it is devastating. And whether or not we like it, we, all of us in Kansas City, drink from the Missouri River, which the mouth of the Missouri River, the Minnesota, is up at Standing Rock. And I was privileged enough to drink water from the mouth of that river. And it's imperative that we protect that for ourselves and the other 18 million people that live downstream from that.
It's true, too, that this particular pipeline in the Dakotas, why is the native population so involved in this particular action?
It's a continuation of 500 years of colonization, of displacing natives from their own land because of corporate interests. And it always has been that way ever since, you know, 1492. And it will continue to be that way, apparently. They poisoned us at Standing Rock, and that was done by government people. And many water protectors have been tested and found to have industrial levels of chemicals that are only available to the government in their bodies. So that, plus all the violence that they incurred upon us with dogs, water cannons, rubber bullets, mace, batons, leaving people outside of the jail until they had icicles hanging off of them, transporting them in buses with the windows open in blizzard conditions. People would like to think that this is in our past, but it is very, very much in our present and obviously going to have to be in our future.
And there is so much fake news that it's good to hear from someone who is actually on the scene.
Absolutely.
And has seen it. Before I turn to Carol, I want to ask you about your other volunteer work with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
Absolutely. I'm a novice sister satire icon for the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, and we are a group of nuns of a of a perpetual order that seeks to spread and promulgate joy and safe sex awareness and knowing your status. So we dress up in whiteface. So if you can think of like a mime, that's what whiteface is, but we put a lot more glitter on ourselves and wear a lot of sparkles. And it's been a wonderful group that's done a lot of fundraising, and it's always a joy, I think, to people to see the sisters out and about, which we do often in bar ministry. So it's been very fulfilling and fun.
Oh, it is great fun at yes. Pride to see people's reactions when
oh,
the
yes.
sisters come by.
I feel like Marilyn Monroe getting my picture taken every 2 seconds, you know. Get to live as a celebrity for a couple hours.
I want to ask Miguel about the DACA decision, the dreamers, mm-hmm. the young people who will be affected when it's supposedly due to end in 6 months. First, let's talk to Carol Rosenfeld about why in these times with so much fake news, with so many people who seem to want to be in ignorance, why is literature and reading still important? And by the way, she's the chair of the Publishing Triangle Awards.
It's a great question. I think that reading, first of all, reading, and especially reading books by people who come from cultures other than the ones that we grew up in, is a window into different kind of life. And it's a great way to start to get acquainted with a world that is different than ours, but also has some things that we can relate to in our own lives, which is one of the things that I was thinking about in terms of this particular book. And I think that really, literature has the ability to take us, because sometimes it's very hard to be in the present right now, and it has the ability to take us to other places out of where we are right now, and we also have the ability, looking back through history, to learn from history what people have done when they've been faced with situations like this.
I agree. It's rare that I read a memoir where I don't see at least one truth that I think, oh, I know someone, or I did that, or my family was like that, or I experienced that. As you said, it's a window. You may think you have nothing in common with a gay Latino poet from Cuba, and reading the book, it's just fascinating. Let's start in on the book, and when Miguel gets here, I'll ask him about DACA.
Oh, here he is.
Oh, here he is.
Miguel, pull up
wow.
a chair.
A timely entrance.
How are you, my darling?
All right. I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Listeners, we are going to get Miguel on the mic, and we're shifting mics around. Okay. And Miguel,
hi.
To catch you up, we were talking about water protectors and the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and why literature is important. And so before we get to DACA, I want to segue off what Carol said, because you are very involved in literature. You are also a poet, and you're very involved in literary organizations. So would you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so the organization I'm currently mostly involved with right now is the LGBTQ Caucus for AWP, which is the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. It's a nationwide organization. And so I'm the vice president of the caucus, and we're just trying to help give a voice to the writers who are in the program so they can find a space, because it's a conference of about 15,000 writers. They come together, and it's just so many and so overwhelming that you really want to find your tribe and meet with them, and then pretty soon you see the faces that you see. It's like a homecoming, a reunion every time. So what we want to try and do is just create a safe space for LGBTQ writers in that. But I also kind of want to diversify that and say that, you know, there's brown queer writers and black queer writers and people with overlapping ethnicities and intersectionality, so that way people just don't think of LGBTQ as one thing or one kind of person. So kind of bring out the diversity in that. Then I'm also involved in the Latino Writers Collective and just various writing projects around Kansas City. So writing is, you know, it's very important. It's a mainstay in my life, and I work in a library, so I'm around words and people trying to write and wanting to write all the time. So I'm seeing various levels of writing in my everyday life, which is great. You know, struggling writers who are trying to do Comp 1 papers, and I'm like, oh, I feel you. Let's find a good source for you, and this is the librarian you want to talk to, and this is how you format your paper, those basic things, to writers who are major award winners. And I'm like, wow, just share with me your story. And then like, well, I want to know your story too. So we shared on that level. So it's great.
I'm not going to be a very successful devil's advocate, because I have degrees in English literature, I edit books, and I do a book club. So clearly I'm on the literary side. But what's the point of having writing today? Because after all, you can be on Facebook all day. You can be on Twitter. You can be on Instagram. Instagram. There's so much going on in the world. Why bother to sit down and spend maybe 10 hours with a book? What's the point?
So this is what I tell like younger writers who are struggling, especially like the Comp 1 writers. Oh, I don't know what to write. What do you write on your Facebook post? Because that's your initial thought. You're putting it out in the world. So then just expand upon that. You know, you have these threaded tweets. Just put them all together and that's a personal essay. They're like, what? I mean, yeah, just throw some sources in there. Expand on these thoughts and you've got a really good personal essay, which is 3 or 4 pages long, and your teacher will accept that. Oh, I never really thought. They don't make the connection between what they're putting out in posts or things is actually worded in literature. It is, in a way. It just needs to be refined. And the way you become a better writer is you become a better reader. You know, you learn how people organize their thoughts in coherent ways and how they set up the structure of their writing and how they... Social media allows you to just do things in bursts, but if you really want to have a sustained message and something that flows, you find the structure. And I know a young writer's like, oh, but the rules and the grammar and all that. You know, forget about the grammar. Mm-hmm. The grammar is the mechanics. If you find out what the rule of the structure is, what you're working with, that's your safety. That's where you can know I can operate in this area. And then once you know that area, then you can push against those. You can bend those rules. You can finagle here and there. That's where you're creative. The writing isn't in the dumping stuff on paper. It's in the editing. It's in the revising. It's in looking at the structure. That's where writing is.
You should be teaching composition full time. I was once an assistant professor of composition, and I did exactly what you just said. I found my way to it. It took me some time. But I had, in 2006, a student at Rockhurst turned in just a passionless research paper. It wasn't the right length and just hated it. I could tell he hated writing it. So we had a session, and I said, what's your most recent activity where you were really, really excited to be doing it? He said, opening day, you know, fishing in Missouri with my grandfather. I said, there you go. And we went from there. And he turned in a great paper because fishing with his grandfather gave him the hook.
I think it's because young writers who come out of high school, they're used to writing for the instructor. This is what I want. This is how I want it. So when they come to college, okay, I'm writing for my teacher. So when you kind of sit down and say they're having trouble with their sentence and like, okay, what are you trying to say? Well, henceforth from, no, tell me what you're trying to say. Like, pretend I'm your friend, and I came in here and said, what are you writing about? What would you tell me? Oh, well, I did this, and okay, then just put that down on paper. But it's not right. It is right. Just put it on paper, and then we can fix it. Don't worry about the grammar. That's the mechanics of it. You can't, you know, just put the story. If you can tell a story, then you're a storyteller. Everything else is like riding a bike. You know, you'll learn how to steer and do all that kind of stuff. That's the mechanics of it. Let's just get the story out.
I want to turn to Carol here. We were in Half Price Books in Westport last night, and she said, oh, I have a story in that book. And was it edited by Greg Herron?
And Gene Redman also.
And I want to ask you, is what Miguel is saying, does that make sense to you as a writer, as a poet?
Yeah, definitely. Because I'm from an older generation, my schooling was probably different than what younger people are getting today. So that may also have affected me.
Definitely. And I was of the generation, because I'm older, where we were busy diagramming sentences.
Oh, yes.
And so the mechanics came first.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can worry about the content later.
Oh, yeah. For me, I'm like, you know, there's a push to have use they and them pronouns for people. And I really struggle with that. Because the diagramming person within me says that's singular, not plural. But I know the way young people are using language now, okay, I have to like accept that. And the way they post on Twitter, I has this, or I'm a poor, and I'm like, okay, that's not grammatically correct. But that's the way they're communicating. So on this platform, it's acceptable.
Right.
But if it was in a term paper, let's,
well, I
let's
actually
find
had,
the real words for it.
I had different levels of editing for blogs and for daily news and for radio and for magazine. Whole different levels of editing, from very casual to more formal English. Why don't we start out talking about Richard Blanco's writing in this book, since we're talking about writing. What did you think of the way it was constructed and how he set his memories out? MG?
It took me a little bit to get into the book. I think about halfway is when I really started to appreciate it a little more. He definitely writes like a poet, and we tend to over-describe everything. And I say that about myself, knowing that. And I do see evidence of that. So the editor and myself was sort of like, well, we could have cut this, or we could have done that a little bit. The last half of the book is, I feel, a little more action-packed, I guess. That was kind of the meat that I was looking for in this memoir. So I was happy to get that. And it was set up nicely. Like I said, the beginning was a little slow, but the ending was definitely structured in a way that, you know, the flow was nice, and the transition from him finally being able to accept that he is gay at the end was also nice. So,
and thank you for mentioning that you were reading it with the poet's eye, because he was an inaugural poet. Mm-hmm. For President Obama. And he was the first gay, Latino, youngest poet.
Immigrant, I think. Also.
An immigrant. Yeah. So, Miguel, what about you?
What I like about this book is that it's kind of all over the place for me. I agree with MG that there's a lot of poetry imagery in there that I thought, you know, the editor probably could have helped him work on that a little bit. But I think because of his background as a poet, they wanted to infuse or make that bridge with a lot of stuff. What was really difficult for me is that when you open up the book, there's a lot of italics in there, and I don't really like that when you're talking about a language that's not English, because then it makes it even more foreign, it makes it more other. And so every page is just riddled with italics. And so, like, into chapter two, I'm like, oh my God, if I see another page, if I turn this page and there's and it just got me, there was a point where I thought, I can't read this book because it's just upsetting me. I'm focusing on the visual and I'm not getting the story. But then things start to happen a little bit where he works in the grocery store and I start meeting interesting people and I persevere through the italics. Which it's through the entire book. So you visually, if it upsets you, then listen to the audiobook or something.
That fascinates me because it didn't bother me at all. But see, I was telling them I had 7 years of French, 2 years of German. I only had a year of Spanish. So it helped me. Oh, we've got Spanish coming. Yeah. For someone who has Spanish, I could see how it would be distracting.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, as a writer of color, whenever something is takes part of your culture and says, this is not normal, so we're going to italicize it so that way you'll know that this is not an English word, that just makes it even more other.
That you needs know, to be a panel at AWP.
Yeah, it does. And I was at a writing retreat with Melinda Lowe, who does a lot of young YA writing, and she's like, don't ever put things in italics. That's just crazy. If there's a word that people don't know, that's what Google is for. They can look it up. And back in the day, people would have dictionaries with them when they read, and they would look up words the old-fashioned way. And he does that a lot. When there's a Spanish word, somehow he'll work in the translation directly after it, which I think is probably meant for another audience, not me, who's familiar with some of these terms, or somebody who's used to picking up, saying, hey, Siri, what does this word mean? So I think that's maybe for a more kind of a lazy reader who just kind of wants to read through. But if you're kind of an active reader who will stop and look at it, look up what this word means, or look where on the map where the city was, then that's the kind of interactive reading that I think some people still like to do.
I'm going to go home and think about this. That is really interesting.
Yeah, there's it's done with the French and some Asian things. So.
I have to do it in some of my writing, and it's always infuriating.
I have done it in blogs and so on, and I thought I was being helpful. So this is very, very interesting.
Well, I have to, when I turn in stuff for publication, I have to tell the editor do not italicize any of my words unless I want them italicized for stress. Not for language. And then they'll send me the proofs back. I'm like, nope, this. And they're like, well, why? And then I have to explain to them. And then I have to give them examples of other notable writers who don't use their words italicized. And like, oh, okay. But if it's just me, they want to push back. And it's kind of this thing in the literary world that's happening now. I mean, it could go back, swing back the other way where people want to embrace this otherness of the language. But right now, it's more stop.
Well, as I screen films, unnecessary subtitles bother me. Yeah. Like, well, those subtitles weren't necessary. Why did you put them in? So I'll make that analogy. Carol, what about you?
Well, in terms of the poetry, I think that poets, one of the things that you try and do is to describe something, whether it be in a landscape or an emotion, and you're trying to do it in a way that hasn't been done before. So I got a sense of that going through. You know, I definitely felt that, again, this was like a poet writing, that there was definitely that there. In terms of just what we were just talking about, the italics, I was just going to look and check because I was thinking of the chapter where he meets the Jewish woman in Florida and in Miami, and I was wondering if, I think she used some Yiddish words, and I was wondering if they were italicized.
Yeah, they were. I had to stop and go back, and some of her words are italicized, but like when they're eating borscht isn't italicized, but when they're eating the roasted pig, that's italicized. So it's not even consistent throughout the entire book. So I think maybe maybe it's a copy editing thing, or maybe borscht is such a part of the American vernacular.
I think it's part of the vernacular.
So it's just things like that.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and we're coming right back. This is Elizabeth Anderson. I'm your host for the Santa Moran Radio Book Club, and we are discussing today Richard Blanco's The Prince of Los Cocuyos, and I want to have a chance to talk to Miguel about immigration and DACA. And do you want to explain what that is and why this book is relevant?
Yeah, this whole debate about DACA was happening while I was reading this book, and there was one of the chapters called It Takes a Pueblo, where Richard is starting working at a local market. There's this guy, his name's Don Gustavo, and he tells him, he's really harsh with him at the beginning, but then he slowly breaks and starts telling Richard how to sort the fruit and how to do this and that kind of stuff. And then during their conversations, he starts telling him the rules of being an exile. And one of the rules is, to be an exilo will kill a man. May you never have to leave this country of yours. And so when I read that, I was like, oh, that's totally the situation that young DACA people are facing right now, because this is their country. You know, they were born somewhere else, but they were raised here. They know this land. And I kind of feel that way about Kansas. I was born in Texas, but I live in Kansas, and Kansas is my home. So for someone to say, you can't live in Kansas anymore, I really don't know any other place. I have memories of Texas. I grew up a little bit in Texas. So I'm trying to, like, figure out, extrapolate that for young DACA people, and just the fear and uprooting of their lives, having to be deported or taken away to somewhere that they've never really known, that they may or may not have relatives there. It's just scary and frightening.
And many are contributing to the economy and the culture and the society of our country.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, and I know they mean this in the best way, is they're trying to say, look, seeing how much these DACA kids contribute to our economy. But even if they didn't contribute to our economy, they contribute in other ways. And they're still human beings and people. So even if they didn't add anything to our GDP, they're still people, and they are still adding to the life of our community in that manner. So it's not all about money and what they do. Although they do pay a lot in taxes, they don't get any student financial federal aid, they have no criminal records, they are exemplary even beyond what U.S. citizens have to have to do for their background checks.
Unfortunately, many in this administration do prize the GDP.
Yeah.
And their personal economy.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when the world follows a business model for governing, for education, for so this whole concept of that a businessman or business person can save every aspect of our culture is ridiculous, because even though there is a business to art, it's still art, and even though there's business to education, it's still education. So you need someone with that background but has the compassion and the understanding of whatever field, and I don't think we're getting a lot of that in the business leaders that we have.
Speaking of background, I saw a Facebook post that said, take any dreamer, put that dreamer up against the President of the United States, and ask questions about the history, the culture, the political scene, and if that dreamer wins the debate, they all stay.
Yeah.
That would be too easy.
Yeah, it would. I'm filled with anxiety and stress, not for me, but for the people that I know, the friends that I have. Thankfully, through social media, I've been able to connect with a lot of people who just happen to be undocumented. But when this first started happening, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, and I knew people were undocumented, but they were speaking out and saying, undocumented and unafraid, I was like, don't do that. Don't speak out. Just please be quiet, because you're putting a target on your back. And then I realized, they want to. That's the way you do it. That's the way that LGBTQ people did it. If somebody told them, stay in the closet, don't step out, you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt people that you love, just be quiet, then we wouldn't be here today having on this radio show.
I have a young friend who has spoken out openly about being undocumented. I've worked with him on the film festival, the LGBT film festival. I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. Let's turn to the book. Let's talk about immigration. Because his family was fleeing, well, they had their lands taken away, and MG, you said that's happened in this country, people having lands taken away. His family goes to New York, and then they end up in Miami. But all the way through this book, there's the theme that he doesn't really have a country. Can you speak to that, MG?
Absolutely. I was born in Santa Barbara, California, but my entire family has lived in New Mexico for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I lived in New Mexico for a short time, but when I was about a month from turning 7, we moved to Kansas City because my dad got a job at Hallmark Cards. So moving to Kansas City was a humongous culture shock for me. I had a different accent from everyone else. I looked different from everyone else. I used to watch the news at night to change my accent. I asked my mom, well, like, what do people from here sound like? And she said, well, watch the news. That's what they sound like. And so I watched it every night starting at age 7. And I didn't learn Spanish like I was telling Carol. Spanish is actually my fourth language. It's not my second or my third. It's my fourth because it took me until about the age of 20 to decide that I actually did need to learn Spanish. I'm too Latino for one side, not Latinx enough for the other side. I used to be called the gringo cousin like he is in the book by my cousins in New Mexico. So I definitely identify with that. It's hard to balance so many worlds, especially when it's not just a binary of worlds, but, you know, being queer and person of color and also, I guess what you could say, a radical, then you definitely do jump around a lot, and it's hard to keep those all in a continuous flow.
And I want to ask Carol, can you imagine New York City, where you've lived for how many years?
I've been there since 76, so.
Okay, so that's a while. Imagine a New York City with no immigrants.
No, I can't imagine it.
What do immigrants add?
Just an incredible amount. Certainly in a lot of the neighborhoods, a lot of the neighborhood stores are run by immigrants. And I think there's been like a kind of an evolution of different groups of immigrants taking over, say, the deli kind of things or laundries or things like that. Maybe one group started out and then another group came in. And food, I mean, I was thinking about that the other week when I was reading this, that, you know, so many things that we take for granted as, well, you'll say like, oh, let's go out for Chinese food tonight, or let's go get Mexican food, or Brazilian food, or anything like that. I mean, that's all because it's been brought to this country. It didn't originate here. We wouldn't have the culture that we have had it not been for people who came here from other countries, from other cultures, and wanted to make a life here, and did.
Miguel?
Yeah, I was just going to say that what you mentioned about food, it plays a major part in this book. He wants to eat that easy cheese that comes from a can, and that's his goal, is to get to Winn-Dixie, and his abuela will not go there because that's where the white people shop, and she feels out of place. And then he works in a grocery store, and then they barbecue the pig. So food is just a theme throughout this whole book because it's part of culture. And even when he eats the borscht, he's like, oh, this is a different kind of food. Pierogi, that's a different kind of food. He's examining all these different things. And so that's really how people are exposed to other cultures, is through food. And he uses that as a great metaphor, but it's also part of his life of how food was there, not only for his ethnicity, but then when he starts becoming aware of being gay, it's because he's working with another man baking bread. So then there's that, you know, the touching and the sensualness of baking and the loaves. And so it's just a really big theme throughout the book, which I really enjoyed.
It did. And this is when I realized how funny this book was in places, because he is bringing some American food into the home and his abuela is busy making it Cuban. And he's like, no, that's not American.
Yes, you ruined it.
Yeah, you ruined it. It doesn't taste American. I want it to taste American Pop-Tarts and so on. I think one of the funniest episodes was when he lures her into the... It's Winn-Dixie.
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 Okay. He shows her ads for chicken is on sale.
Oh, yeah.
That's our loss leader. Look, you can get chickens. She goes in, and how many does she get?
Oh, they loaded up.
I think they like, get like 10
chickens.
Yeah,
10 chickens.
Yeah,
and they're
but
only
it's
allowed
a limit
two
of
each.
Two. Oh my God!
And she is frustrated. She isn't comprehending because, you know, she speaks Spanish, and the cashier's trying to explain to her in English.
And everybody's always trying to cheat her.
Yeah,
because she cheats everybody. So
she's a bookie.
Yeah, yeah. So she's always looking for somebody cheating.
And poor Richard is trying. Ricardo is trying to explain Grandma, and she's talking so fast. And she's not listening, and he can't explain that they're not trying to cheat her, that those are the rules. And what did you think of that scene?
There was so many layers to that, because immigrant children are like the translators. They're the adults in public, but they're also the children. So I could identify, like, he had to be the adult in that situation, but then he was also embarrassed of her, but then he also loved and hated her, and then there was this American and Cuban thing going on, but he wanted to stay in the store, but he really wanted to get out of there. And so there was just a lot of layers that were happening, and I just found that really interesting, because that's kind of how it is when you're, you know, an immigrant kid, a young person of color. You want to be in that area, but you don't want to be noticed, but you want to belong there. It's like when he's pushing the carts with all the other, he says, all the other housewives shopping around, and he's nodding to people when he goes there by himself. He's like, that's his home. So I just thought it was strange how there was just so many layers to that scene, but then also the pressures or the stress or the importance that we put on young immigrant kids to be adults when adults can't function as adults, you know, because of language or culture. It's tough.
Carol? Any thoughts on that?
I guess I was wishing in some way that the woman that was checking her out had been more understanding. Not realistic, perhaps, to wish that. It does make you aware that a lot of times how that language can be a very frustrating for both parties. That's what I'm kind of thinking about, and we all have ways of reacting to that.
And I think there is a tendency for English speakers, because I've seen it, if someone's not understanding and they're French or they're African or whatever, they get louder and more insistent. You're not understanding. You can't have that because you can only have two chickens. Da, da, da. And that is even harder for someone English is not comfortable.
Yeah, someone screaming at you, especially when you don't understand, is never a comfortable feeling.
And then calling the manager, and it's like, it just escalated really quickly.
It's like, look, I just wanted to buy this thing and go home. Like, I don't understand. I have the coupon. It has the picture of the chicken. I am taking the chickens. I am giving you money.
What
part of this is rocket science here?
Exactly.
But there's this thing, speaking of grocery stores, there's this thing that I do when I go shopping is I'll stand in line and the clerk will say, you know, how did you find everything okay? To everybody in front of me. When it's my turn, silence, nothing. Because they just assume that I don't speak English. So I like to play this game of how long it's going to take them to realize that Miguel speaks English. Sometimes during the day they'll say, oh, is this cilantro or is it parsley? And then I'll tell them it's cilantro and then they realize I speak English. Most of the time it's at the very end where they say, thank you, here's your receipt. And I say, oh, thank you. Or what are my fuel points or whatever. I'm like, oh, then they realize that I speak English. But I'm like, okay, so I sit there in line and I think, okay, how long is it going to be? Sometimes right away, did you find everything okay? Those are more like the younger check clerks who are like high school people. The older ones who kind of like, that's their main job, that's their full-time employment. They're kind of like, well, here's somebody who's brown. I don't really need to speak to them because they're not going to understand what I'm saying anyway. So yeah, that still happens.
And it's wrong.
Yeah.
One of my favorite times when my sons were small, we were living in rundown apartments by UMKC. They've been torn down. And we were in the elevator and there was an elderly Chinese gentleman. And he's just standing there in the elevator and we're waiting to see if it's broken or working that day. My son, who was probably about 4, just started counting in Chinese, 1 to 10, which I did not know he could do. And the man turned and he just lit up. And he indicated, keep going. And my son is like, that's all I know. I'm only 4. And I just counted for you in Chinese. And they became best buddies. They would bow to each other. Yeah. And it was funny how just that one little thing could make a huge difference.
That kind of reminds me of the Yetta at the hotel, and he, you know, Richard's there with his cousins, and he thinks he's going to be the star of the show with his older cousins and put on their makeup and be just another girl with them. But then they push him aside for his older brother, who's more their age, and so he hangs around the pool with Yetta, and she's just like, "So what's your story? What are you doing here?" And he's looking at her jewels, and you can just tell there's a connection that they have there, and she's the queen of the copa, and that's how it is with young people. They kind of gravitate to people who are like them, even if they're not of the same age, because when you're younger, you don't see those things as barriers. You just see, you've got the same light that I do, so let's hang out together. Yeah.
I want to go back to Yetta, but we have to take a break. We're going to play a song. We're going to come back. Thank you for coming back. We are talking about The Prince of Los Cocuyos by Richard Blanco. And we had just started touching on the subject of one of his friends, Yetta. MG, would you talk a little about her and their brief friendship?
He meets Yetta when they're on vacation, and she's like the queen of the copa, which is the place that they're staying. And she's an older Jewish lady who apparently had spent quite a bit of time there with her husband long ago, mingling with celebrities in the prime of their lives. So in her retirement, she's returned. And since he's been shunned by his girl cousins and his older brother, where they go off to have cool fun by themselves, he meets this lady and starts hanging out with her. And she decides to share some of her culture with him and feeds him borscht and pierogies. His family assumes that he's up to no good with this lady, so they rather dramatically enter where he's playing bingo, and they both raise their chulpas at him. Yeah, so if you've ever, the thing about getting smacked at the sandal with the chancla or the chopa, the house shoe, it's very real. And whenever anyone raises a shoe, I cower. So it was rather funny that to save himself, he yelled, bingo.
And it's also funny that his boy, I think it was his abuela, said, is there bingo tonight?
Bookie.
Miguel, I want to ask you, he doesn't know what Cuba is.
Yeah.
He's never been there, and his parents and abuelo keep talking about how wonderful it was, and it's a mythical land to him. So what was interesting about what Yetta told him?
What he found out through her is that she's from all over here, she's from all over the place, and he's like, yeah, that's me. He never really thought about being from any place because he's supposed to be Cuban and he's supposed to be from Cuba, but he's also American, but he was also born in Spain, so he didn't really ever know where he was, but he could never vocalize it. He never had somebody from outside his head or outside his world say, it's okay to just be from wherever, you know? It's okay to be like that. And so that kind of sets him off on the rest of the journey of the book of where am I and who I'm from? Is it okay to disturb the universe? Is it okay to... So he starts asking himself a lot of larger questions. While I was reading this, I was kind of thinking some of his insights are really advanced for somebody his age. So maybe that's like when you're writing your own memoir, you can put some of your adult knowledge into your younger self. But I think if this was a book of fiction, I would be like, there's no way an 8-year-old kid could be wondering about Marilyn Monroe and Dean Martin at the Copa and in Havana. Just, you know, I'm about the same age as Richard, and there's just no way that I would think of Marilyn Monroe and Dean Martin having drinks in Havana.
There is Miguel the Cynic.
Yeah, but there are some really big eternal questions that young people start asking, and he puts those in the book. But they're kind of tinged with his hindsight of being an adult. But I think for me, what really like sets him on his journey is his friend who gets the Corvette, and that's what really makes him question. Mm-hmm. You know, my friend always like just pushes the envelope, and he's not afraid to disturb the universe. And what am I so afraid of? And I think for me, that is really like where the second half of the book comes alive. I think that's really it.
I want to ask Carol, you raise a very interesting point, because we read Janet Mock's Redefining Realness, and we read Charles M. Blow's recently, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And now that you mention that, I think their memoirs were tinged with adult knowledge. Is it possible, Carol, to write a memoir without having that infusion of adult knowledge?
No, I wouldn't think so. I was just thinking that at one point I was kind of interested in doing a children's book, and when I submitted it to an editor for his comments, he said, but it's written like as an adult looking back on, it's not written from a child's view, it's written as an adult. So that was a very good point. I hadn't really thought about that.
So, I mean, so kind of one of my areas is YA, and they're always like, write in the voice of, in YA you have to write up. So if you're writing for middle grade, your characters have to be 15, 16 years old. If you're writing for, you know, young adults, which are 18, 16, 18, you want them to be in their 20s or late teens, early 20s. So you're writing up. But a lot of books for young people are written down. They're written for 10-year-olds with the capacity of of an adult. And so it's kind of weird. So that's, for me, I'm aware that when I read books for young people or about young people, are they authentic in that voice? But I think in a memoir you can do that. You have permission to imbue your person with some adult knowledge, because that's why you're coming to read this book.
And we were talking about his friend Yetta, and he was also close to his grandfather, his abuelo. He talks about some of the happiest memories. It was a good few months at least when they had Cuba in their backyard. MG, could you talk a little about that?
Well, his grandfather started out with, I think, one chicken, and then it expanded to several chickens, and then it expanded to a chicken coop, and then there were bunnies, so he won a bunny at a fair, so then they got another bunny, and then all of a sudden there was a bunch of bunnies, as bunnies tend to do, and so there was a bunny hutch after that, and then came the dog, because his older brother Kako didn't have a dog.
Yeah.
Then came the neighbor lady who called animal control on them. But for a few months, they had their own eggs. They gave eggs away for free. They eventually had to slaughter the chickens because of the call to animal control. So that was rather sad. And my mom has a similar story of my grandmother, who had a pet pig that was also slaughtered, and she refused to eat it, much like he refuses to eat his chickens. But then it was kind of awful, because like the lady dies. So...
in a really horrible way. Yeah. So, like, at first I was like, oh, that lady is like every bad neighbor I've ever had. And then I was like, oh.
Oh, now I feel bad.
I
think that's one of the things I enjoyed so much about the memoir was some memoirs are consistently poignant, nostalgic. Others are more analytical. And his tone was all over the place because, as you said, it was humor and nostalgia turned pathos and tragedy. And what did you think of his varying voices, Carol?
When I was reading the early part, you know, what struck me was that there was a lot of humor in it, and yet there were things that really were sad, too. Like, he wanted to make the rug, and his grandmother took the kit away, the rug-making kit, because it wasn't masculine. And that really was, you know, I felt bad. It reminded me of how our families really try and shape us into a particular gender many times. And it's something that I hope has gotten a little bit better for today's kids, that, you know, they're not so rigid about what they're allowed to do or wear or be interested in, really.
She was constantly criticizing him. And he had a teacher. He was so excited to help the teacher decorate the classroom. I've seen little kids. It's not so much a gender thing. They want to make things look nice.
Yeah.
And he's called Ricarda. Discussion in this book about the criticism that he's not macho enough. Miguel, what did you think?
Yeah, that's that permeates Latino society, whether you're Cuban or Mexican or whatever. I mean, just the language itself is masculine and feminine. So if you want to insult somebody, if you want to insult a man, you use the feminine form. Language is such a beautiful thing, but it's also such a tool of oppression. Not only that, but, you know, we call each other gordo and flaco and, you know, skinny and fat. Those are things that if you said them in English, hey, fatso, that would be rude, but in Spanish, you put a little ito on the end, and that makes it cute and endearing. It's still passively aggressive, and it's still hurtful. So that's the thing about language that really is one of its downfalls, is how we use it to oppress other people, even when people are using our knowledge of that language to oppress us. So I always find that a language oppression is cyclical. You know, someone's policing their language, so then they in turn police language of other people, and it's just a way to control and the frustration of the push and pull of language. So it has a really big place in this book as well, the, you know, language being called Ricarda, and just the names of the people. There's a couple of tios and tias that they were confusing to me because there were just so many parading in and out of the cast of characters. But yeah, I enjoyed it, and I think language played a really big part. And sometimes I had to like pause and figure out, you'd call Google and look up what this word in Spanish was or what this relation would be. He's my brother's cousin, sister. I'm like, okay, in terms of how we define things in American, is that first cousin removed, second cousin removed? So that's a little bit right to figure out.
The LGBT community is dealing with language. And is dyke a slur? Is it something we embrace? Is queer a slur? Is it something we embrace? I appreciated that part of the discussion. He was really examining words and how they're used. MG?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's funny that he comes up with all of these nicknames also for other people.
But,
but they're never anything like, you know, attacking their sexuality or gender. They're just, like when he calls his friend Vampiro or Nene, like, they're just kind of cute nicknames. But, you know, I definitely agree with that. And there's been an entire movement to degenderize the Spanish language and other romantic languages that are genderized. So, like, for instance, we don't say Latino or Latina, we say Latinx. In other ways, like when we write, we'll use an X instead of A or O, which is, I think, integral to dismantling the machista patriarchy that's existed in Latinx culture forever, almost, because it is so heavily, as Miguel said, embedded in language, and something that, since it's embedded in language that we use every day, it becomes embedded in ourselves. And so to eradicate that, I think it does take a definite cultural and shift in language.
Yeah.
And I would recommend to anyone who picks up this book, you will enjoy the trip to Disney World.
Yeah, that was probably, for me, that was the chapter that I think he didn't imbue any adult. That was like truly his young self writing that chapter. And that's why it was so enjoyable, because everything was so new and wonderful.
And colorful.
And colorful. Overall, I think it's a really good book. It's got a lot of different tones to it, and it's funny, but it's not an idealized childhood, because he realizes that he makes some mistakes and he does some things wrong. And that's what a good writer would do. They would show the bad part of themselves as well. So I enjoyed it for that as well. It's a good read.
And Carol, would you recommend people read this book?
Oh, of course. I thought it was really both. It was fun funny and kind of sad, but it's definitely a journey. You're going on a journey with this wonderful writer. So, yeah, I think so.
MG?
And I'd like to encourage everyone to A, read this book, and B, read other memoirs by Latinx authors and other people of color. That's the easiest way that you can find similarities with other people. And there are also voices that get ignored and marginalized a lot. So make it a point to pick out a non-white author and read their memoir.
Yeah, definitely.
Excellent advice. And I want to thank all three of you for being on this panel. And we've been talking about Richard Blanco's The Prince of Los Cocuyos.